Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 10 years ago this week, the Bush administration flew 20 men to a detention center at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, a 45-square-mile enclave at the eastern end of Cuba, which the U.S. secured in a 1903 treaty and has held ever since. According to the Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg, as of this week, the military had 1,850 U.S. troops and Defense Department contractors on staff at the prison, holding 171 detainees. 89 have been cleared for transfer, but they still remain at Guantanamo. According to reports, current detainees went on a 3-day hunger strike this week. Some refused to return to their cells for the 4-hour nightly lockdown. Human rights groups around the world and former detainees marked the anniversary with rallies and demonstrations, and around 40 people were arrested for demonstrating in front of the White House this week. The anniversary received widespread coverage in the national media, focusing on President Obama's broken promise to close the facility, Congress preventing the administration from transferring detainees to the U.S. for trial, and conditions inside the prison. But where is the coverage about the men who are still there? What about coverage of whether Guantanamo will ever close? And where is the coverage about what this really says about U.S. values? Independent journalist Andy Worthington has been covering Guantanamo since it opened. Over the years, he's interviewed detainees, retired military personnel, human rights activists, and attorneys. He just launched the Close Guantanamo campaign for people to support the closure, and he's author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And Andy is in the States, here in the Bay Area. He'll be speaking today at noon at the Lewis Mayer Lounge over at UC Hastings, 198 McAllister here in San Francisco. Hi, Andy. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be here.
Great to have
you back.
I've
just mentioned briefly that that's a free event as well. So
yes, thank you.
Anybody can come down in their lunch hour.
And I will be talking about this throughout the show. We're also joined today by Scott Horton. He's contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and his latest piece is called Gitmo at 10. He says the media have ignored two important issues, and we'll talk about that today. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rose.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Julia Varadi. Julia is a radio journalist with Club Radio in Budapest, Hungary. In recent weeks, huge anti-government protests have taken place on the streets of Budapest in response to a constitution that was just implemented. Three journalists have been on a hunger strike for nearly a month, protesting media repression. Two have been fired. Since December 10th, they've been living on nothing but soup and tea. Government officials are trying to shut down Club Radio, where Julia Varadi is a journalist, and she joins us from Budapest. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for calling me.
Well, thank you for joining us. So as we always do on Friday, we like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. Andy, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
This week. I don't know. I suppose I've been so immersed in the Guantanamo story, actually.
Where are you seeing good coverage on Guantanamo?
I was seeing a certain amount of people turning out and mentioning it because it was an anniversary. I'm not sure. I think you covered it very well in your introduction, actually. You said, where are the more probing questions about what this means? And I've been so caught up in that story that I'm not sure that I've seen particularly great reporting from the mainstream. I mean, Scott has reported well on it. and I think the best voices that I heard were actually not from the media covering the events in Washington, D.C., but were from the people taking part in it. We had an amazing conscientious objector who was a young man who had been part of the guard force at Guantanamo. I've been so appalled by the way that, you know, the systematically the prisoners were dehumanized. This is a current story. The system is still designed to dehumanize people. He's so appalled, he's turned against it. And the joy with which he greeted people protesting about something that had deeply, deeply troubled him, you know, somewhere very emotional and moral inside him. He was fantastic. It was really impressive.
What is his name?
I can't remember.
Well, we'll find it, and we'll put a link on our website. What happens to conscientious objectors who work at Guantanamo?
I think the difficulty for everyone who you know, takes a stand against what they've been required to do. I mean, there are guards over the years. There are people who have, you know, Scott Horton knows because he interviewed military personnel who had worked at the base, who questioned the statements by the officials that three men who died in June 2006, that they died by committing suicide. Mm. Whenever anybody does that, they go out on a limb. You know, and it's very difficult for people because they risk, you know, being cut off from everything, being left destitute for having turned against their employer. So I think, you know, we all need to recognise the bravery of anyone who actually steps forward and publicly complains. What I know that's interesting is that behind the scenes, what we wouldn't even hear as much about is that for all the people who have gone public and what they've done has been so important in revealing the truth, for all of those people, there are 10, 20, 30 other people who have spoken to former prisoners to apologise for what they did to them. They don't want to go public. They've probably got, you know, they've probably got issues about not wanting to step over that line. But there's a lot more behind the scenes that people don't hear about.
Hmm, we should do a show about conscientious objectors. And we'll definitely talk more about this later in the show. That's Andy Worthington, independent journalist. And what about you, Scott? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'll give you two, since Andy didn't quite give you one. I'd say, first of all, in Guantanamo reporting, I would give a kudo to Carol Rosenberg. I think she wrote an article at the beginning of the week in which she very patiently worked through the question of why isn't Guantanamo closed in view of Barack Obama's promise during the election that he was going to close it by the first anniversary of his swearing in. And she tells us that, you know, he took a slow approach to this. He didn't act decisively when he could have at the beginning of his administration. But then she focuses on what Congress has done, because it's really been, you know, death by a thousand cuts, a long series of legislative initiatives led by Republicans in Congress that have been designed to tie Obama's hands and make it almost impossible for him even to wind down the population in Guantanamo. And I think she demonstrates how this has become a domestic political ping-pong ball within the United States, and how the Republicans in Congress in particular have been using it effectively. And then the second story I give you is one that's out today, and it deals with the constitutional crisis in Hungary, which is another thing we're going to be discussing, which I would pick is probably the most underreported story in the American media so far. And Kim Shepala, professor at Princeton University, has written a piece at the New York Times website in which she takes us through the constitutional dilemma and shows how the Fidesz party there has put forward a new constitution that basically is a sort of a legal coup d'etat in the country, in which they're attempting to install themselves as the forever government and undermine the liberal democratic guarantees that the Hungarian system had. And she does this by way of presenting a background. Why is there a conflict now between the EU and Hungary? Why are concerned voices being raised? And I think by and large, most Western media writing about this are they're simply too overwhelmed by the complexity of the Hungarian legal changes, as well as the Hungarian language, which very few people have a command of. And I think Kim's piece is the first really good effort to unwind all of this and explain it patiently.
And how did you run across this piece, Scott? Because we ran across this just finding an article about a hunger strike led by journalists and then read about the Constitution.
Well, I was in Budapest late in the summer and talked to some lawyers there who flagged the issue for me. And when I came back, in fact, I looked up and spoke with Kim Shepley because she's you know, been an expert in these areas. And then she flagged it for me. So so that's how I came to it. But again, I applaud you already for picking up and dealing with this issue, because I think it's a huge one that's gotten almost no attention.
Right. Well, the Christian Science Monitor had a pretty good piece. Julia Verratti, you are in Budapest. And where are you seeing good coverage of what's happening in Hungary? Are you looking at American coverage of what's going on there?
Yeah. For instance, we read Kim's article, which we also liked a lot. It means me and my friends. And this is fantastic that somebody who is so far It can be so objective and knowing so much about Hungary. We really need this because I think that the world has to know about what is going to, what is happening right now in our country. And we have to shout out as far as we can that people see how democracy can be just ruined in a very short time. So the question whether the story is covered in Hungary, I must tell you that the part of our media does cover it. And if you ask me what good things I recognized in this last week, then I must tell you that there are some, not too many, but some brave journalists in Hungary who try to cover all the important stories and happenings in our country. And this is very, very important. And also I'm proud of those civil people who try to help to just to do something against what is now happening in our country, to stop this ruining of democracy, as I said.
Well, and Julia, as Scott said, Hungary doesn't get much attention in the U.S. media. So why don't you give us a little background here? Hungary is in the 27-nation EU, but it uses its own currency, and it's been sharply criticized for the new constitution. Citizens are saying that it restricts personal freedoms. The Christian Science Monitor reports that, quote, no other nation in Europe has made such sweeping and overnight change in its basic laws and approach, and with little public consultation. And the EU is now threatening legal action over this. So how did this come about?
Well, this is, of course, a very long and very, very complicated story. I think we should start, if you have time, by the changes in 1989, where the older enthusiastic about finishing the socialist system and hoping on a real freedom and democracy. And the problem was probably that the changes which we were believing in were not real changes. So there were a lot of things which have changed, and freedom came up to us, and we could finally travel out of our country wherever we wanted. We could listen and hear whatever we wanted. We could speak loud out, and as journalists, we could express our thoughts. But in terms of political culture, this country did not have any source where to learn from. And this was probably one of the basic problems. But there was another basic problem coming up later. There was a young party of people who, as young Democrats, wanted to bring a real change. And many people believed in them because they looked really very, people who really will bring us a good future. So many people were voting on them, but not enough, of course. So they didn't win an election until 1994. From 1998, from 1998 till 2002, they were in the government, and they were not much better than the former social liberal government. They did a lot of things which were proving, but they did bad things as well. But on the top of that party was and is Viktor Orban, our present prime minister, who unfortunately is a person who, as we know him since a long time, and many people who knew him since his childhood, know that he is a person who cannot lose. So he, for some reason or another, he believes that he has to have the power all the time, and whoever wants to fight against that, he will push the person down. And this was a very bad point from where he went out when he lost the elections after 2002. And from that moment on, he did everything to split Hungary in two parts. That happened. Year by year, it got worse and worse. And then we had a socialist liberal government for 8 years. And this is not in vain that it was for 8 years, because there were some people who really wanted to make reforms, make change everything, which was not very well done until that point.
That's okay. I wanted to ask you how the government is suppressing freedom of the press, because Global Post reports that last year the government set up a media council to control state broadcasters. And since then, journalists say the situation has gone from bad to worse.
Exactly. So this is, in fact, the ending of the story I started to tell you a little bit longer than you wanted. The end of the story is that this person and this party is now on the rule, and they established the constitution also, and they established media law, which established a media council. On the top of that media council is one person who is put there by this by the government. It means by that party. So all the members of that council are supporters of the party, or themselves are party members. So there is only the Fidesz, our party, which is now in the government. They are delegated into that council. This media council makes all the decisions about the media, and they made also the decision about the public radio and television. They made the decision about the public corresponding center, and they made a decision about the frequencies which are to be given out each 7th or 8th year. And this is now when our radio as well had to apply for its frequency, and we didn't get it in a very, very unright way.
And Scott Horton, since you've been following this closely, what questions do you have for Julia?
I guess I'm a little bit concerned about the libel situation as well, because, you know, I see that they've changed the regime so that the state prosecutor can pick his own judge when matters are being brought forward. And there seems to be a strong revival of libel actions being brought by figures in this government. And I'm wondering, is this intimidating the press? Is it chilling press coverage of what's happening there?
Yes. It is intimidating. The press, if you have heard about it, I'm sure you did, that there are big demonstrations in this country, first of all, in the in Budapest itself, in the capital, against this government now, and against the constitution, and against the law business, what is going on now. But about the demonstrations, for instance, there is only 2 electronic media which give the real objective information. This is, the one is a television station, a private one with a very small support, and another one, which is a club radio, the radio I'm working for, which is also a private radio, and which is going to be shut, as you know. So the coverage in some newspapers, you can read about it or see some pictures. But for instance, the public media does not give the real truth about those demonstrations or about everything which is a little bit against the government.
And Andy, do you have any questions for Julia?
I don't. I mean, you know, I hadn't been covering this. It's obviously very deeply alarming when such an assault on openness is taking place. And I mean, it troubles me, obviously, in the sense of Hungary, and I have my Hungarian friend back in the UK, but also that I think the world is in such a is in such trouble at the moment that one of the temptations for people is to seek security in the arms of people who, as we've seen in the past, frequently turn out to be on the right wing, and not to offer actually security and safety to people, but to offer something much darker and more dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. But is that a question or you just gave a statement? Because that is the truth, what you are saying, that on one hand, this government, although it says that it's apart from the extreme right wing, which is unfortunately sitting also in the parliament, but there are actions which show that they sometimes think very close to what the extreme right believes. And this does not give a safety feeling for the population in Hungary. For instance, you have heard probably about the theater where the head of the theater is kicked out and not elongated his term, but another guy who belongs to that right, extreme right-wing party, he will be the director of that theater. So the first time in Hungary's life, a kind of a Nazi ideology supporting person is going to be a director of the, of a theater, which is, I think, terrible.
That's very bad.
Well, and also in the Constitution, you've got a jail terms for the homeless now.
Right.
It's, there's a strong anti-abortion clauses in there. How common are protests in Budapest?
Because how common is the protest? That's
yes,
what you're asking?
Yes, because in a lot of the pieces I've read, it says they're very rare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's not true. Protests are more and more frequent. Just a week ago, or a little bit more than a week ago, there was a big protest, and the constitution was celebrated by the government and by the friends of the government in the Opera House, which is a beautiful building in Budapest, a huge building from the 19th century. And the people went on the street, and there were at least 80,000 people, which is a real big amount now in Budapest. When it started a year ago, when we protested against the government first, then we were 10,000, and this was also a big amount. But now it is getting more and more. Next Sunday, so in a week, we are going to have also against a demonstration against the media law, against the stopping of freedom of speech for the Club Radio, the radio which we are talking about. And people are really very excited about it. In the Facebook, you can see how many people in one day are supporting a demonstration like that. So I'm not agreeing with that there are not enough protests.
And just quickly, what is the status of the journalists who went on hunger strike?
In the public television, which is supported, of course, from our money, from the taxpayers, they made a false picture where they covered out, so you could not see a person in the background of somebody else's interview because they didn't want that person to be in the picture. So what they did, they made this trick that the listeners, the audience, couldn't see that other person. And therefore, those journalists who were in the television as editors and reporters, they protested against it, and they went on hunger strike because nobody...
Julia, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have to go to break here. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be sure to have you back.
Okay.
Thank you. Julia Virati is with Club Radio in Budapest, Hungary, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. You can join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that keeps them aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. Just click on the email newsletter link on the front page of KALW.org, and thank you. Thank you.
This is Your Call. You can find out more information about the show and leave a comment on our new website, yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Monday, we'll have a conversation about the UC Board of Regents. Who are they? What are their responsibilities? Who holds them accountable? Recent meetings have been disrupted by students concerned about budget cuts and tuition hikes. So what do you want to know about the 18-member UC Board of Regents? That's on Monday. On Tuesday, we will have a conversation about the widening income gap and race in the United States. Wednesday, we'll carry California Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State, and then we'll open the phone lines to find out what you think about the current state of California. And then we'll also have a conversation about the state of reproductive rights in this country. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we're going to switch gears here now and talk about media coverage of the 10-year anniversary of Guantanamo Bay. 171 detainees are still there. 89 have been cleared for transfer. This has received extensive coverage this week. What did you think about the coverage? Did you hear the personal stories? Did you find out what the conditions are still like? Do you think the reporters asked the right questions? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. How do you think journalists should continue to cover this important and ongoing story that has both national and international angles to it? And then also, if there was another story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by independent journalist Andy Worthington. He's author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. Andy will be speaking today with Truthout's Jason Leopold at the Lewis Mayer Lounge at UC Hastings, 198 McAllister. It's a free event. It starts at noon. And then Andy will be at an event tonight at the Cypress Restaurant, 81 Shattuck over in Berkeley. It starts at 6 o'clock, and the suggested donation is $40. And this is an event to close Guantanamo. And we're also joined today by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His latest piece is called Guantanamo at 10. So, Andy, why don't we start off with you? You've been covering this extensively. When you've got something like a 10-year anniversary, and there are so many different angles to take here, how do you go about reporting this? Because I noticed that most coverage focused on President Obama's broken promise to close the facility and the administration preventing the transfer of detainees.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not bad to touch on some of the issues. I think the biggest question is how do we keep this going for more than a few days?
Right.
The news cycles move so fast. Anniversaries get mentioned. You know, it happened with the 9/11, the 10th anniversary. It moved on. Everything moves on very swiftly. So the issues here, you can drop them in as a soundbite in your articles or your coverage, but the facts that you're covering remain something that needs to be, that people need to keep digging at. So over half the people there have been cleared for release. The United States government doesn't want to carry on holding them, but they're held because of obstruction by Congress. Or because with the case of the Yemenis, who make up two-thirds of those men, the president also bowed to pressure from critics. When a Nigerian man was caught with a bomb in his underwear on a plane on Christmas Day 2009, and he was found to have been trained in Yemen, that's when the hysteria started. The president, in response to that hysteria from Republicans, said, no more Yemenis are being released. These men are being condemned to guilt by nationality. That really ought to appall people. That's not fair. That's not people who are a threat. It's people who are being detained for political reasons. So finding a way to keep pressure on these issues, I think, is what's important. It's part of the reason that with some other of the lawyers who'd worked on the Guantanamo cases, I helped to establish this website, Close Guantanamo, because we want people to sign up. We want to educate people. We'll be providing prisoner stories throughout the year. We want people who do care about this to sign up. There's a petition on the White House's We the People website. Get 25,000 people to support that, and the president will reply. It's another way of showing that there are people who care, that there's a willingness out here. And we want to be able to keep focusing on the issue throughout the year in a way that the media will drop in and out of it. So, you know, that's one of the issues. I mean, I think other issues to do with the prison are, how are we going to accept that it stays open forever? Because if we're not, then, you know, just reporting on it isn't going to do, because we'll have an 11th anniversary, a 12th, a 13th. If there's a bigger picture here, how are we going to put pressure on... Who are the right people to put pressure on to say, this will be your legacy? Now, I think one is the president, and I believe that President Obama knows that it's embarrassing to have said he'll close it and then not to be able to. I believe that at certain levels he knows that it's atrocious to be holding people that he doesn't want to hold, but he hasn't found the will to do it. Well, lawmakers have a responsibility as well. Maybe people need to start campaigning for lawmakers to say, you also are going to care what people say about you when you're old and retired. Do you think that it will be appropriate to say, these are the bunch of guys who presided over the endless life of this gulag, where people died of old age there, never having been charged or tried, in a very un-American manner. Do you want that on your record? Because people in positions of power, authority, tend to care about their legacy.
Scott Horton, what are your thoughts on that? How do you keep this story in the media?
Well, I think one thing we've seen that's been important in the course of the last few days is that we've seen finally a bit of a focus on individual stories. So, I mean, we saw Lakhdar Boumediene, we saw Marat Kanaz, both publishing recollections, and the New York Times. There have been a few other individual cases. The story has been dominated, frankly, by fear-mongering in Congress for many, many years, with the entire prison population in Guantanamo being portrayed as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, basically, these scraggly, long-bearded, convinced terrorists. Who were willing even to confess to their wrongdoing. And the truth behind Guantanamo is that when this camp was opened up in 2002, January 11th, it was filled very quickly with people who were turned over by warlords in Afghanistan for bounty payments and were turned over by Pakistani police. 80%, 90% of these people were in the wrong place at the wrong time, certainly not the senior leadership figures from Taliban and al-Qaeda for whom Guantanamo was envisioned. And we also know that by October 2002, there had been reviews of the prison population by the CIA and by the FBI, and the people doing the review had come to that conclusion. You know, we had a group of nobodies. And we know at that time they actually went to the White House and made that presentation. And the Bush administration's answer was, this is 2 weeks before the election. The president has determined that they're enemy combatants. We will continue to hold them. So political expedience drove the Guantanamo experience, and that's still the case today. We're still not breaking out of that.
Well, that's what really struck me about the coverage. You've got 171 men there, and I don't think I found one story that really talked about the fact that these men were in the wrong place at the wrong time and have been sent over there, have been tortured. I mean, people have written books about this. You mentioned Lakhdar Boumediene's essay, which ran in the New York Times, and highly recommend you reading this. It's on our website, yourcallradio.org. I mean, the poor guy was brought up and swept up in Bosnia and sent over to Guantanamo. Said he was tied up like an animal. He went on hunger strike. He was force-fed, tortured. I mean, the information's out there. So why isn't that in these articles?
Because I think most reporting wants to focus on the policy issue and the question of, do we need a Guantanamo and should we keep it open another 10 years? And I think the part of the problem is there seems to be a consensus within a lot of the editorial pages in the country that that this is here to stay. It's not going away anytime soon. And I think, you know, that in my mind is shocking. I mean, if you look at public opinion polling, you'll still see very, very strong numbers supporting Barack Obama's view that it's the right thing to close the camp. But what we don't see is political resolve coming out of the White House to implement that promise. But I think we've seen a little bit of a shift in the last few weeks. Again, I think this anniversary has provided one occasion. I think there was another thing, which is the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which was another massive effort at Republican fear-mongering with a number of Democrats who went along with them. And I think that backfired on the Republicans in a big way. I mean, to the extent now that we even see Republicans in their presidential primary attacking the whole NDAA ploy, this idea of indefinite detention. In fact, that's now lit a fire on the political right, with many people on the political right saying this is a horrible mistake and who's pushing this. So we're seeing definitely a sense, even amongst people who have been the fearmongers, that they may have been playing this a little bit too long and a little bit too dangerously, and it may be about to boomerang on them.
Yeah, and I was going to say as well, you know, the thing with the NDAA and this mandatory military custody provision for terror suspects, people who could be allegedly tied to Al-Qaeda, that came out of Congress with no one having prompted them to do that. That's reflected very badly, not just on Republicans, but on a large number of Democrats who also voted for it. I think that's playing very badly with people on the left, liberals, progressives, with libertarians, because it strikes so fundamentally at the heart of the laws on which the United States was founded. What I think is sad that was missed in the discussions was that people have been focusing on whether this might happen to Americans and have failed to notice that actually this is what people at Guantanamo have been subjected to for 10 years. So if it's unfair and monstrous, then it should be unfair and monstrous for everybody. But, you know, I think it certainly has helped to create a debate where there didn't appear to be one before, that these senators have shown themselves to be, I think, either desperately afraid and out of touch, or cynical fearmongers. I think it's it could be both, but neither of them reflect well on Congress.
Well, we have a caller on this. Let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Yes, hi, Rose. Thank you. You know, I agree with your guest. This is embarrassing for this country. It's totally unnecessary. Civilian courts could handle this easily. But what has surprised me more than anything else on this whole issue is the powerlessness of the president. He cannot close it. If he just goes out and say, I'm closing that tomorrow, there's no way he can. He does not control the money of this country, and that's what it would take to shut that down. Congress controls it. Congress has been using this as a football. So I'd like to hear from your guest, and perhaps he could enlighten me more, but I believe the problem is with Congress, not with the president.
Well, thank you for that, Roger. Scott, can President Obama shut down Guantanamo?
Well, the answer is right now, he literally does not have the authority to do it. Congress, and a lot of that has to do with budgetary constraints. The caller is exactly right. So if he's going to shut it down, he would have to move people to someplace, either release them or turn them over to another prison facility. People like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is getting ready to stand trial, of course, is not going to be set free. And Congress has said that he may not expend appropriated funds to transfer them to another prison facility. So they've quite cleverly tied his hands. But it is also true that in his first year, roughly year and a half in office, he was not subject to these constraints, and he could have acted to shut it down. And instead, the president decided to embark on a interagency task force to study the situation and give him a recommendation. So he squandered that one gap, that opportunity he had to act, and now it's not really possible for him to do so.
Absolutely. I mean, there is one issue that you know, that hasn't been noticed that much, and I hope it will be acted on. Certainly attorneys are going to start looking at this. There is a provision that was inserted into the NDAA at the end. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about what it meant and what could be argued about and what could be taken out. And the president is allowed to waive the obligation to clear the release of prisoners through Congress if he decides that it's safe and that that's in the interest of national security. It is something that attorneys will be working on. And, I mean, you know, it is true that there has been a total block for the last year when you have Congress saying the defense secretary has to tell us that it's safe to return a prisoner, that he cannot engage in activities against the U.S. That's an impossible guarantee to make. When Congress people got together and said, if there's a single reported incident of somebody having gone back to the battlefield from a country, you can't release a person to there. I've been using an analogy this week which has played well with my American audience, is to say, let's pick a state. Let's pick California. A man is released from a prison who's from California. He goes back to California, he commits a crime. The people of the country making decisions in Congress get together and say, on this basis, no prisoner from California will ever be released from prison again. That's what's happened at Guantanamo. That's so grossly unfair. That and the guilt by nationality of the Yemeni prisoners who the government doesn't want to hold but can't release because its hands are tied. The president has helped to tie his own hands on that. These are issues that are so fundamentally unjust that the only hope I have, really, is that they will not carry on being less unjust. They will stay there to mock anybody's principles of believing in fairness and justice in this country.
Well, and on that note, what has changed at Guantanamo over the last 10 years? Because I have heard people like the Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg, who's been consistently following this, saying that conditions have greatly improved. Is that true? And do journalists have access to prove that?
Well, journalists have never been able to utter a single word to a prisoner or to have a prisoner utter a single word to them. So it's totally untransparent in that sense. In terms of it being a more humane facility, it's certainly true. And, you know, you could cynically say that that's because President Obama realized that he wasn't going to close it, so he might as well make it more comfortable for everybody because they're all going to be there for a long time. But the reason to make people uncomfortable, and the reason in the early days people were very explicitly tortured, was because that was the Bush administration program of isolating people, of torturing them or coercing them or bribing them to produce information that they thought that they had, that they for the most part didn't have. So that's all unnecessary. It's a legacy. It's a pointless, hollow legacy now, Guantanamo. The political difficulty is how to close it. So it's better for them. But with one proviso, people in federal prisons may have had a trial that they will say, you know, the trial wasn't fair. But they had a trial, they were convicted, they were sentenced, they were told how long their sentence was. The people in Guantanamo who have never been tried, never been charged, never been convicted, do not know when, if ever, they will be released. Now, 8 years ago, a representative of the International Committee of the Red Cross told the New York Times, "We're very concerned about the impact on the mental health of the prisoners of this open-ended detention." That was 8 years ago. It hasn't changed. It remains that every day, and that really ought to shock people.
You know, and that's what gets me, because I'm so interested in the personal stories. The ACLU had a video 2 years ago of five men who've been released, and they talked about being sodomized, raped, tortured, you name it. And they talked about how difficult it has been to just sort of go back to life because they don't have any help, right?
Yeah.
So that's another question here, that if these issues are not really being raised in the U.S. media, what do we owe these people? Are they just sort of sent away? Good luck. And in the case of the man who wrote the essay in the New York Times, Lakhbar Boumediene,
yeah.
He was in custody from 2002 to 2009. He's now living in Provence, France, and he worked at the time when he was swept up for the Red Crescent Society in Bosnia. He said only a few human rights groups have seriously considered hiring him. He can't even find a job,
yes.
Let alone get to know his family again.
And he's in a Western country that's not even looking after him properly, it sounds like. So certainly other people have been released to other countries where there's no help for them at all. But, you know, that's a complicated issue because Republicans have seized on recidivism issues, claiming how many people have returned to the battlefield. They made that it's very dark propaganda. They don't back up their claims with actual facts and figures that can be studied. And they are undoubtedly exaggerated. They really are. These are for dark propaganda purposes. But
when we've seen some things cited in the past, and you go back and you look at them, you see someone is described as having gone back to the battlefield because he made a comment in the media that was critical of the United States.
Right.
So it's really quite ridiculous. But I think this compensation issue, frankly, is a huge issue because under the Convention Against Torture and other international agreements, the U.S. agrees that, you know, if we torture or mistreat a prisoner, that person's entitled to rehabilitation, to treatment, but also to compensation. And I think one thing that the Congress has done is systematically taken steps to make it impossible for people to present claims for compensation or to be compensated, which is ridiculous. It's, it's a neglect by the United States of a clear obligation. And I think the demonization of all these people as terrorists is part of that operation. You know, of course we can't compensate them because they're terrorists, even though we now know certainly 90% of them are not and never were.
Yeah. And, you know, they all remain enemy combatants. It must be said that apart from a few people, the Uyghurs, I think, some of the Chinese prisoners who held there, everybody who is free is still walking around designated by the United States as an enemy combatant. Mm-hmm.
That is independent journalist Andy Worthington. We're also joined by Harper's Scott Horton. And we have just about 5 or so minutes left. If you want to get a call in here about coverage of Guantanamo, we'd love to hear from you. Or if there was another story you wanted to talk about, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We had a caller who wanted you both to talk about what this all means for Bradley Manning. And how does the NDAA affect Bradley Manning? Scott Horton, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Bradley Manning case, you know, charges are going to be have been approved. They're going to go forward. He is going to be court-martialed. I don't really see any direct connection between Bradley Manning and these things. But, you know, one of the menacing facts from his Article 32 were claims that he was doing all this to advance the interests of Al-Qaeda. So there's definitely going to be a prosecutorial game, I think, at his trial, attempting to link him to Al-Qaeda, saying he was working with the enemy. I don't know what evidence the prosecutors have to say this on, but based on everything I've seen, that strikes me as specious.
Absolutely.
And claims of that sort were made in Guantanamo also repeatedly, and almost every time the prosecution was put to its proof, we discovered they had no proof. So this is done mostly for public propaganda purposes, not because they had real evidence showing these things. But this, again, is what I call the process of demonization. You have someone and you want to silence them and block any development of public sympathy for them. You link them to the enemy. This is a tactic that's been used from the beginning of time, and it's really a reprehensible one. But I think we may well see it with Bradley Manning. And I think the solution with Bradley Manning is to say, compare Bradley Manning with Dick Cheney, frankly, with Pete Hoekstra, with Richard Shelby, with a number of advisors of President Obama. All these people leaked sensitive information to the media, and only one has been put in solitary confinement for long periods of time, was denied access to an attorney for long periods of time, and has been subject to a campaign of vilification in the media involving the U.S. government.
And it'll be interesting to see how much media are sort of, quote, allowed to cover the Bradley Manning case and how much access there is there.
Tremendous restrictions put in place on the hearings in Fort Meade, in fact. I think there were, 20 places available for the media, and media people were not allowed to take cell phones or other recording devices into the hall. It was made extremely difficult to cover. A number of major publications decided not to because of those limitations.
I think Scott made a great point there about the claim that there was some connection between what Bradley Manning did and Al-Qaeda. That ties in alarmingly with the NDAA, because people said, you know, lawmakers want mandatory military custody for terror suspects. Like, anyone could be a terror suspect. No, actually, it says Al-Qaeda. But here we get an example of how anybody can be tied to Al-Qaeda for what Scott called specious reasons. Exactly right. But that might be manipulated and used. That's very troubling.
But we have to note military custody in this case is entirely okay, because of course he's a soldier. He's wearing a uniform. There's really no question about it.
I also wanted to ask you both. We don't have much time. Who is making money off of Guantanamo? Because according to the Obama administration, taxpayers are spending $800,000 a year to keep individuals per person in Guantanamo. The prison camp staff will not explain this. The Miami Herald filed a FOIA request in September to find out how the money is being spent. The Pentagon in Miami is now assembling the documents, and there's an attorney which will decide how this might be released. Who's making money off this? $800,000 per person, Andy?
Well, contractors are making a lot of money. A former commander who spoke recently spoke about the waste, huge waste of money, because everything has to be flown in. Paper napkins, paper clips, everything from the biggest to the smallest thing. The alarming thing about these figures are, when will people start to become concerned about money being wasted? We spoke about the 89 of the 171 men left there. Over half of them cleared for release. The government doesn't want to hold them. That, they are costing $72 million a year to hold men that the government doesn't want to hold. Can we not find a better use for $72 million every year?
Well, that's a clear distinction, because the cost of housing them in the U.S. in the Supermax facility will be $26,000. So $26,000 versus $800,000. So it's a matter, it's a point of vanity and pride for Republicans in Congress that they should be holding Gitmo at the cost of just a little bit less than $1 million a person every year. It's completely ridiculous. But who is benefiting? I mean, the only information we really have right now is on the construction side of things. When the facility was built, we don't have information about the maintenance. And we know that KBR and Bechtel were the two big winners with respect to the construction there.
Hmm. Well, final thoughts from both of you. Where does this go from here? And what responsibility do the media really have to bring in these angles?
I think the media has a responsibility this year not to accept the status quo. It's 1 year since the last living prisoner left Guantanamo. Two dead people left in coffins after that. Mm. There is such a clampdown by all the branches of the government at the moment that releasing a single person is difficult. What we will be trying to focus on is the person who we hope is the most likely to be released. He's the last British resident in the prison. Shaka Armour, cleared for release by Bush, cleared for release by Obama. It's Britain. Lawmakers won't be able to call the United Kingdom a terrorist nation. He can be released, but the pressure needs to be exerted. So we'll be campaigning. Activist journalists will be campaigning. Lawyers will be campaigning. Will the mainstream media pick up and help on this? That's what we'll see.
Scott, quick final thoughts?
Well, I think the Shaka Armour case is a very, very interesting one, because his release seems to be made dependent by the U.S. on him going somewhere where he's going to be gagged. I mean, the U.S. has said basically they'll happily release him to Saudi Arabia, but they're not so willing to release him to Britain. And I think there are fair questions to be asked about that.
Well,
but I think the next big issue is going to be the 9/11 trial, the KSM trial coming up, and how the media will be able to handle that. That's something that can be easily sensationalized. It's going to be a very important event.
Well, we'll definitely cover it. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and Andy Worthington is an independent journalist. At noon today, he'll be at the Lewis Mayer Lounge at UC Hastings, 198 McAllister in San Francisco. It's a free event, and tonight at 6, he'll be at the Cypress Restaurant. It's a fundraiser, $40, 81 Shattuck over in Berkeley. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
And thank you so much for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. Who are the UC Board of Regents? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how the 18-member board is appointed, how it operates, and how it influences decisions at 10 UC campuses across the state. What are their responsibilities, and who holds them accountable? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Recent meetings have been disrupted by students concerned about budget cuts and tuition hikes. So what do you want to know about the UC Board of Regents? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.